This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
What if a game-changing climate event struck on the other side of the world and you didn't know much about it? India and Pakistan just went through a record-smashing early heat wave lasting not days, but months. Bill Spindle was there. Bill is a Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow in India. Before that, he was South Asia Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. Where are you located right now, Bill?
Hey, Alex, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. I am currently in Ratnagiri is the name of the town or the area along the Konkan coast, which is south of Mumbai, 4 hours drive south along the coast.
I think the furthest south I've been along that way is Goa.
Yes, I'm a little north of Goa, sort of in between Mumbai and Goa. And as you may or may not know, your listeners, I'm on a long journey through India. I started all the way on the other side of the country in Kolkata, visited a number of areas there, came across the country through the Northwest deserts, down through Mumbai, and then I'm now heading south. And I'll go across the country and back up again in a big circle. And the whole time I'm looking at sort of climate impacts along the way, and also energy transition issues in various places. So we can take it from there.
Well, that's perfect for this show. That's what we're about. What was it like day to day in that massive heat wave?
Hot. It's a kind of oppressive heat. I would just describe it as like having when you're in a taxi with the window open, and some of the taxis here are not air conditioned. If you have the window open, it's like having a blow dryer right into your face. And the most difficult thing is it really doesn't recede a lot in the evening, especially in the cities. And so, as you can imagine, most Indians don't have any sort of air conditioning. That's just beginning here. The middle class is able to get some air conditioning, but mostly Indians don't have any air conditioning, and many in rural areas or in urban slums don't have even fans. So their situation really becomes quite dire under those kind of heat conditions, especially when they go on sort of day after day, week after week, as they did this spring, where we touched, temperature highs that really would be records even in the summer, when the heat, like now, is really generally when the heat really starts to pick up. But it began really in March this year.
Well, they found in other places, including in Britain, that when heat events happen at an unexpected time of year, the first one to come actually causes more deaths than subsequent ones, where people are a little more mentally and maybe physically prepared.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it did catch people unawares here. And the real only saving grace of it all is that it came before the rainy season, so you didn't have high humidity in many places where you would normally have higher humidity if the rains had come. Because that's really the great fear that everyone has going forward as temperatures begin to sort of rise, is this what's called the wet bulb temperature, the combination of humidity and heat, which doesn't, if you have high humidity, it doesn't require incredibly unprecedented heat to get to a point where the human body really can't cool itself down, because it can't sweat off can't cool its core by sweating. And so you can get, even in the low 90s, if the humidity's high enough, you can get lethal levels. And we didn't have that during this particular heat wave, but that is a big fear for the future.
Was there smog as well in the cities?
The smog tends to recede in the spring. It's the worst in the winter because of the way the cool air is trapped by the Himalaya Mountains. And you get a buildup of smog similar to what LA used to have in the 70s. So the smog wasn't that bad, but air is never very – air pollution levels, even in the best parts of the year, are really – quite bad, particularly in northern India.
Well, let's see what the record keepers say. The Scientific American writes, quote, "Northwestern and central India, some of the worst affected regions, are believed to have experienced their hottest April on record. The country as a whole saw its hottest March in 122 years of recorded history, and its fourth hottest April this year," end quote. This sounds like a breakthrough climate event. Bill, do you see it that way?
Yes and no. I think it is an event that really got everyone's attention, not only globally, but here in India. And it really raised awareness of the acute threat that various climate impacts have. On the other hand, India has had big heat waves before. Slowly, there's been a realization that particularly cities need to prepare themselves for this. And there's been a spread of these so-called heat action plans. There was a big heat wave in the Northwest, I think it was 2011, perhaps, where a couple thousand people died. And so they've come up with plans that try to better predict these events, try to get the word out to particularly poorer communities that this is happening, try to get workers off the streets, try to distribute water. And they, you know, they do help. And I think this is a broad theme, really, in sort of climate-related events in the developing world, particularly India, is the way that there are ways people can respond to these things. They can adapt. Communities can figure out ways to mitigate the damages, the threats. Cyclones are a big example. You know, massive cyclones have hit the coast, used to kill thousands and thousands of people. Through fairly simple measures, like just having much better predictive capabilities that through weather forecasting advances and building big kind of hurricane shelter, cyclone shelters in even really poor rural areas where a whole village can go up and get above the water, have really cut the deaths down dramatically. And you see some of the same phenomenon with heat. By reacting to it with a coordinated plan, they can reduce the mortality levels and stuff. But the important thing to understand is there are limits to this sort of adaptation. You can only do it to a certain extent, at which point it begins to overwhelm the system and you really can't mitigate for it anymore. You can't really adapt to it in any ways. And I think that's the big fear going forward, is that these events become more common as they're accompanied by other climate events that we can talk about. I mean, these heat issues are far from the only climate impacts I've seen on my trip so far, and that India is experiencing. So as these kind of different climate effects, you know, they kind of collide into each other, they reverberate, they cascade on each other, it becomes more and more difficult to adapt. So there's just limits to how much you can do, even though there is a lot you can do on all of these fronts, and a lot that Indians are trying to slowly do. There simply are limits to it over time.
This is going to come back. The UK Met Office saw proper to issue a special assessment on May the 18th, and they said the chances of a record-breaking heat wave in that part of the world has been made over 100 times more likely because of climate change. So it's going to come back. Now, writing in the Atlantic magazine in May, you said the world has no choice but to care about India's heat wave. Why is that?
I think there are a number of reasons about it. I think, you know, first off, India is now the second most populous country in the world. About 1.4 billion people live in India. By the end of the decade, it'll be the most populous country in the world. So just simply from a humanitarian perspective, India will likely be the country that experiences, where the most people experience the most severe impacts of climate change. So simply as a humanitarian matter of just caring about other human beings, this is the place, India is the place where the most people will experience the most extreme impacts likely over the next couple of decades. But that then definitely reverberates out beyond the country and has global implications. You know, there are certainly concerns about migration. If large swaths of India become essentially uninhabitable, those people will have to move elsewhere. And, you know, those will cause disruptions both across borders and within India. It will have a big impact on the economy. And to the extent that, for example, America is increasingly moving into a partnership with India in the Indo-Pacific, for example, for security reasons, for trade and economic reasons, you know, an India that is hobbled and struggling with climate impacts throughout the next several decades is simply not going to be as good a partner, both economically, security-wise, or anything else, as an India that is got these problems in and these challenges under control. So those are some of the reasons. I think another is simply that India, on the other hand, flip side of the coin, has a huge amount to offer in terms of mitigation of climate change globally. It's already the third largest contributor to emissions on a historical level, of course, very little contribution cumulatively over time on a per capita basis, very small compared to Europe, the United States, especially, or even China. Yet it is emitting quite a bit more fossil fuels, and it is very dependent on coal. So whether India and how India is able to get its renewable energy sector moving, and we can talk about that. There's just been huge progress in that area. India's got great promise in things like solar, wind, and is moving into this whole hydrogen space. So India has a lot to offer in terms of both cutting its own emissions over time by building a whole new energy system based on, you know, with its backbone in renewables. It's well on the way to starting that project and is making really quite amazing, remarkable progress in some ways. So that's, you know, I think that's another important reason. And beyond India, it will show the rest of the developing world ways in which to go about this challenge of how do you build a sort of new energy system on top, you know, instead of Europe and the United States, which essentially have to replace an existing huge energy system. India doesn't really have to do that quite so much. And places like Africa really don't need to do that at all. They don't have a giant energy system built up based on fossil fuels yet. And India can really, I think, be a leader in showing how to build out a new energy system as opposed to replacing an existing one. And that's really the challenge that India has and the developing world has.
In the West, billionaires like Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates promise big money to push energy transition. In your blog, The Energy Adventurer, you reveal two fossil fuel heavyweights appear to be shifting a little towards greener power. Please tell us about Mukesh Ambani and the world's largest oil refinery.
Yes, there's two. I think one big trend we've seen is that solar in particular and renewables generally have gone from smaller companies here, upstarts that have made tremendous progress and have driven the price of solar really down like 90-some percent, 95-plus percent, I believe, and made solar and renewable energy really the cheapest form of it, of energy in India, at least while it's being, certainly while it's being delivered. But a big trend recently is that, you know, not only is the government staking big, ambitious plans to roll out a big uptick in renewable energy over the next, you know, 10, 20 years. But big companies here like Mukesh Ambani's Reliance Corporation, Gautam Adani's is another giant kind of mogul here that's built his fortune on oil and gas. NTPC is the big, largely government-owned power generator, that very, very coal-based. They're all moving quite decisively toward renewable energy. Now, that doesn't mean they're cutting back necessarily on fossil fuels. In fact, at the world's largest refinery that I visited recently, they're making, you know, record margins refining oil and a significant chunk of it, Russian oil. You know, they're not, and Adani is kind of a coal baron in some ways. He's got a giant, very controversial coal mine in Australia, mines in Indonesia. They're bringing in coal as fast as they can bring it in. They're refining oil and gas as fast as they can refine it right now. So they're not giving up on that. And yet they are putting quite massive resources into renewable energy right next to the oil refinery that I visited, where they're doing all that, taking in all that oil from everywhere, including Russia. They are also laying the groundwork for a giant solar panel manufacturing facility. And that will be eventually, according to Reliance, followed by a hydrogen electrolyzer plant, a fuel cell plant, and a battery plant, all on a massive scale. Now, those are all still on paper. It will be a long time till those are all rolled out. But all in all, that Reliance's plans there, were they to carry them out to the end, and they're pretty serious about it. I think it really is one of the world's most ambitious integrated renewable energy projects. It's really quite huge and typifies India's approach, which is let's build out renewables as fast as we can in many ways, but at the same time, we're going to need traditional fuels as well. And we'll see how that plays out over time. You know, that's a message that a lot of environmentalists find quite scary, because we really need to be reducing coal, you know, starting yesterday. And oil and gas really probably need to follow, not soon afterwards. But that the thinking around that is, I think, shifting in India. But, you know, right now the whole energy system is built on coal and imported oil. So it's going to be continue that way for quite some time to come. But it will be interesting to see how renewables, whether they're solar, wind, hydrogen, hydro, how they begin to push. You know, can they basically be built out faster than demand expands and therefore start pushing coal out of the system? I don't think that's beyond the realm of possibility beginning after 2030. You may see things move faster than people expect and are willing to talk about now. But for now, it's a kind of we need it all approach that works for India and is not entirely in line with global goals to reduce emissions globally.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, veteran Asian correspondent Bill Spindle. David Wallace Wells, in an opinion piece in the New York Times, writes, quote, "According to one paper cited in its most recent report, India is 31% poorer thanks to climate change, which has already made global inequality 25% worse. So India has actually become poorer than it might have been if they'd had the same stable climate that the West had when we were industrializing. So the game isn't really very fair."
Yeah, and Indians at all levels will be very quick to point all of this out to you. It is not fair. It's not fair that they're paying a higher price for emissions that they are not responsible for. Looking historically, they've contributed a very small portion of the cumulative greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And even today, on a per capita basis, they're really emitting far, far less than the U.S., Europe, Japan, China, everybody. But it is true that they are paying a higher price. South Asia is one of the most exposed areas to climate change, certainly. I think there was a Standard & Poor's consultancy put out a report not long ago saying that its economy is something like 10 times more vulnerable. So Indians are quite aware of this. And the rest of the world should really be too, because if India's economy continues to pay a massive price, and it will be a massive price over the next couple of decades due to this climate exposure, this will redound to the rest of the world to a considerable extent. As I say, India will be not as good a trade partner as it could be. It will be not nearly as effective a security partner as it could have been otherwise. But also, it's just a kind of loss of potential that will, you know, impact India and the rest of the world if things continue like they are.
Well, I think in the old colonial world, there was the thought that their loss is our gain kind of mentality. But surely COVID, among all other things, shows us that if one part of humanity doesn't reach their potential, we all lose a lot. And I wonder, though, looking at Sri Lanka, is the economy of India stable enough to deal with this even more challenging future coming up?
I think India's economy is a lot more stable than Sri Lanka's, for sure, and a lot stronger and less vulnerable to those sorts of things. But that is a bit of an object lesson about where India and other countries could wind up if the combination of, you know, additional challenges from climate impacts combined with poor management of the challenges. And that's India has generally done far better than Sri Lanka over the last few years, needless to say. But India's government has always struggled to manage the massive population that they have and the massive diversity and economic challenges that they face. So I think being overwhelmed by the climate impacts over time is certainly a danger. But I think, you know, that kind of going back to what you're saying about caring about why to care about India, I think the other thing to realize is that there's a lot of potential for foreign investment to share in all of this. India, you know, has an improving investment environment that's always had some challenges, continue to have some challenges, but They're improving the environment. There are huge opportunities for investment in India's renewable energy sector and green technology sector for foreign companies, some of which are already taking advantage of it. Goldman Sachs, the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, a huge sovereign wealth fund. They're big players in India's energy space. Giant pension funds around the world are starting to pour money in. So there's a lot of opportunity, especially if the ways can be found through some of the multilateral institutions like the IMF, the World Bank, particularly the latter, to de-risk some of these investments. The main problem, I think, is that a giant pension fund is conservative enough that it's worried about risk. If the World Bank and international lenders can find ways to mitigate some of that risk for private investors, then you'll see a lot more money coming in. And that's the real promise of India's renewable sector, I think, is that it is so inexpensive to build solar here. Not that it's easy or without its challenges, but it really is the cheapest form of energy, to the extent that there's really enough for both India to cut its energy costs while putting in renewable energy, and at the same time, foreign investors to get a pretty decent return, particularly if some of the risk is taken out of that equation. So there are these massive opportunities to be taken advantage of. So it's not just avoiding the disastrous potential down the road of these things. It's that there's a lot of potential gain for everybody involved to try to build out India's renewable sector as fast as it can be built out, and hopefully fast enough so that it really exceeds the growth of energy demand, and therefore you can begin to push coal out of the system and get India to a point where it can see huge energy growth, which is what it's going to have because its population is growing, its economy is growing quite rapidly. Its energy use is going to double over the next 20, 30 years. And somehow that has to happen without tripling its emissions. In fact, it needs to do it under its own goal by reducing its emissions eventually down to net zero by 2070. That's a huge challenge and a different challenge than the developed world really faces. But that's India's challenge, and there are ways that foreign investment could play a huge role in that. And that's really, I think, what the next big climate conference, these COP conferences they have every year, that's going to be held this year in Egypt. I think that's really going to be the big issue there, is to what extent and how is the developed world going to contribute and find ways to help India and the developing world in this transition in ways that can very well benefit the investors as well.
Bill Spindle, how long have you been in India on this trip?
This trip, I've been here. I got here in February, started in the northeastern part of the country in February. So I'm about 4 months in. I've got 2 months to go. I was living in India for 4 years prior to 2020. So I'm familiar with it, but I'm learning all sorts of new things as you do when you travel.
Yes, in the East, you talk about it in your Energy Adventure blog. You take us on a tour of some threatened places as you go. Do you want to talk about the Sundarbans? Is that how you pronounce it, Sundarbans?
Yeah, the Sundarbans are a globally unique ecosystem, the largest mangrove tidal estuary in the world. About 40% of it is in India. The other 60% is in Bangladesh. And it is an area that is uniquely vulnerable to climate impacts, partly because it's very low-lying to begin with. Much of it is basically at sea level or barely above sea level. So as sea levels begin to rise, they combine with the other big climate impact they're seeing there, which is more frequent than intense cyclones. And so you get these combinations of higher water levels with huge storm surges from these more intense cyclones and rain from these more intense cyclones. And it really has created big challenges for an area that's really used to things like flooding. And, you know, flooding is part of life there. And they've learned how to deal with it over time. Cyclones are part of life there. They've always had big storms come in occasionally. What's different now is that those storms are happening not once a decade, but they've had four in the last basically 2 years, a year and a half, really. And you know, where they had a cycle before, you'd have a big storm, you'd have a lot of damage. Salt water gets into the rice fields. That makes them basically unfarmable for at least a year or so. As they begin to recover, they need then monsoon rains to begin to lower the salinity level. So over time, they would adjust. And that was a fairly manageable task for a population that's really quite poor. There are about 4 million people there that are really generally quite poor. But they could adjust to those sorts of cycles. What's happening now is that they're being battered so hard and so often that adjustment really becomes difficult. It's that being overwhelmed factor on a kind of middle, a kind of small scale here. And they're having a hard time adjusting. So I went to an island called Goramara, which is basically eroding away, as islands have done there in the past over long stretches of time. But this island's lost about half its land mass and about more than half its population in the last 5 to 10 years, really, as it's been battered by these storms, including one last year that literally put the whole island under 11 feet of water, wiped out everything. Amazingly, there were no deaths during the storm itself. They managed to get into their cyclone shelter above the water level. Barely, but the whole island went underwater. They lost everything. And really, it's at this point, there's really no salvaging much of it. There are a couple thousand people still living there. They have no electricity. They're not ever going to get electricity because the government has basically written the island off at this point. The goal at this point is to slowly relocate the population elsewhere. And so that's a kind of situation that the Sundarbans has faced. I spent a lot of time looking at mangrove restoration, which is one of the main reasons that many of the islands down there and the communities are quite vulnerable, is because they've dredged out or one way or another killed off the mangrove swamps the stands of mangroves that provide a lot of protection against those kinds of storms. You know, there you have that combination of sort of human behavior and human interaction with the environment that isn't very well managed, either by the government or the communities themselves, leaving them more vulnerable. And so then climate change comes along with kind of additional challenges, and they're really quite vulnerable to it. That's a pattern you're seeing over and over here, not only here in India, everywhere around the world.
That's the thing. I think you've given us a great vision of India, but it's also kind of a portrait of the future in so many places. Bill Spindle has reported from Asia for Newsday, Bloomberg, and the Wall Street Journal. You can keep up with Bill's insights in his blog, The Adventurer, and the address is billspindle.substack.com. I will put links to that and more in my own show blog at ecoshock.org, as always. Bill, thank you for sharing your insight with our listeners.
Thanks, Alex. It's been great to be able to do this. Really enjoyed it.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.